Welcome to NLP Talks with Laura Evans, a podcast for people looking to unleash their potential in business and life. I'm Laura Evans, international trainer of NLP and host for this podcast series. Join me for insightful interviews with people that know firsthand just how NLP can change lives, and they'll share with you tips and strategies to help you clear your path to success. Stay tuned. Welcome and thank you for joining me. My name is Laura Evans and I'm the founder and lead trainer here at Unleash Your Potential and, of course, your host for this podcast. Now, it gives me great pleasure to bring you the third and final part of our mental health mini-series. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Chris Wright, the well-being guy. Now, Chris did his NLP practitioner course with us some time ago, but today he's here to share his wealth of knowledge and experience as a suicide intervention skills trainer. Now, suicide is a topic that, if we're honest, scares many of us. We desperately want to be able to help, but we don't want to make the situation worse. How do we help support someone in crisis? Chris is here today to bust a load of myths, address some of the stigma, and help us understand some of the signs to watch out for and how, most importantly, to open up the conversation with someone that we think might be in crisis. I know this episode is going to equip you with a load of really great skills. So let's go across and listen to how Chris started off in this area of community-based suicide intervention work from his role in mental well-being.
So my work in mental health and suicide prevention started probably about 10 years ago now. Started off as a one-to-one mental health support worker, working with young adults in a university setting. And I think increasingly we were seeing suicide would be a mix of what was going on for those students, the needing to help them to keep safe and develop their strategies really for helping themselves to keep safe. So I did that role for a number of years. A few years later, I sort of took on management of a team of mental wellbeing support workers. And then, cut a long story short, the role changed a little bit as the years went on. It became more and more management focused. And I was just having less opportunity, really, to deliver training to staff and to people in our local community. And, you know, that was the stuff that I really liked. It's the stuff that delivers impact for me. So I made a decision to kind of step away from that particular role and have been training independently since 2017 as the wellbeing guy. So as you mentioned, yeah, lots of suicide intervention focused stuff. So we deliver a two-day workshop called Assist, which is all about the intervention skills for frontline workers. We also deliver a half-day program called Safe Talk, which is around sort of starting the conversation, developing that awareness and spotting people that could be at risk. Alongside that, I've delivered, you know, your mental health first aids and stuff like that in the past as well. But currently, today, very much focused on suicide prevention. That's my mission for the time being.
Awesome. And yeah, having done your assist suicide training, I've got my certificate here. Yeah. I have to say, as a master coach and as a trainer of NLP, you know, I work with people, as you know, all the time, kind of unofficially, if you like, in the mental health space, because that generally is where, you know, where I end up helping people, stress and anxiety and things like that. And before doing your training, I really felt ill-equipped. You know, if anybody had ever come to me and said, I'm having suicidal thoughts, I would have just frozen and panicked because I had absolutely no idea what to do. Yeah, we'll talk more about your course at the end. But yes, I highly, highly recommend it. It's amazing. So thank you for equipping me with some skills to be able to help other people.
Not at all.
So let's start the conversation off then about, you know, suicide and what it is and, you know, some maybe some stats, if you can, around the extent of the problem. Because I know, as a kind of, as I would call myself, a layperson in this area, you know, over the last few years, there's been ever-increasing press around, and when we had Caroline Flack earlier this year, you know, it's becoming ever more popular, which I think, from my point of view, it's a good thing that people start to talk about it. But I just, you know, I'd like to invite you just to tell us a little bit about, you know, what it is, and some, just give people some scope around it.
Yeah, sure. So I suppose within Wales, statistically speaking, we've got about 350 people a year which will die by suicide. And that's kind of, you know, in terms of reported by the coroner. And there's a whole host of arguments around you know, is that the actual number, or is it, you know, in all reality, probably a lot more, but a lot of those deaths don't get recorded as suicide. We know that 1 in 20 people at any given point will be having thoughts of suicide, which is massive. And that really shocked me the first time that I heard that stat, because I previously thought of suicide as something quite remote and, you know, detached, and it just happens to a few people. But 1 in 20 people is actually quite a big stat. I mean, if you look at the population of Wales, which is where I'm based and where I predominantly train, it's about 155,000 people a year that are having thoughts of suicide at any given time. And I think, you know, COVID aside, we know that the NHS is stretched at the best of times, and access to some of those traditional professional caregivers that we might, you know, jump to mind, like your doctors, your psychologists, your psychiatrists, we know how hard that can be to get access to those people absolutely when you need them. So the whole ethos, I suppose, around the community-based approach to suicide prevention is that actually there's a role that we can all play at a really basic level in terms of spotting people that could be at risk, starting that conversation, helping to try and keep them safe for now, I suppose, and then moving them forward and into those professional support as and when we can get to them. And it's that holding piece, I suppose, and making people safe in the moment, giving them that third option between living and dying, of actually, let's just stay safe for now. Yeah. You know, you're asking about the stats of those 355 people a year within Wales. It's interesting how it breaks down by gender as well. So the stats that we take are from Samaritans, and of those 355, about 97 of those are women. The rest of them are men.
Wow. So that's
a really stark difference there.
Yeah.
I think, you know, quite often we hear the headlines, something we see it on social media, that suicide is one of the biggest killers of men under 45. But I think that stat just goes to illustrate that, really, just how stark the difference is.
Yeah, no, totally. You know, I think when I came on your course, that was one of the real stark, I mean, I had no idea that the gender balance was so swayed. You know, I count myself extremely lucky that I've never, you know, suicide has never been a concern for me personally. And it hasn't really been something that's impacted my friend circle or family hugely. And when you come on a course and you start to realize the extent of it, it's really challenging. I remember on the course I came on with you, we had a lady on the course that had attempted suicide, and that was very real. You know, that was a real light bulb moment for me in terms of that. Can I ask you then, you know, there's a difference, isn't there, between someone who is having thoughts and someone that has gone further down the river, so to speak, and maybe might have plans and things like that, you know. So tell us a bit, because it's not like suicide is not just one great big label, is it? You know, there are so many different elements to it. And I think that was one of my other light bulb moments. It's like, actually, I would feel very happy having a conversation with somebody about how I could help them stay safe for now. Mm-hmm. That's a very different type of intervention than someone that perhaps is in the process of enacting a plan. You know, can you maybe give us a bit of an appreciation of the kind of the I know you, it's a river, isn't it, I think, in the training that you talk about?
Yeah, we talk about the river of suicide within our training as a bit of an analogy, really. Yeah, so I think there is multiple shades of grey within suicide, which is something that I myself probably didn't have an appreciation for before I undertook the training many years ago. And I used to think it was quite binary, quite black and white, that someone was either suicidal and wanted to die, or they weren't and they were in this other camp. But I think actually what we kind of get to grips with and what we unpick is that there are all these different shades of grey in between, and someone may be having thoughts of suicide but desperately not want to die. You know, they may be doing everything that they can with the resource they've got to hold on to life, but perhaps, you know, it's obviously a struggle at that point. I think to pick up on the other point you made, to some extent, fleeting thoughts of suicide, you could argue, are a bit of a condition of human life, aren't they? Because sometimes we all get those really brief moments where we think, oh, you know, wouldn't it just be easier if I wasn't here? And I think, you know, that really is the differentiation that you're alluding to, that there's a difference between those fleeting thoughts and then when someone is actually starting to put plans in place, they're deciding perhaps how they would go about it, they're starting to put affairs in order for a life where they're not there anymore. You know, it's that latter group that we're really focusing on with the intervention work, really, is how can we interrupt that? How can we get in between that and make that situation safer for them in the time being?
So as a member of the public, you know, maybe concerned about, you know, friends, family and things like that. You know, how, like, no one, how can I put this? You don't want to get to the point of having to intervene when you're too far down the river. Mm-hmm. You kind of want to be able to spot those signs I remember us talking on the course about, you know, it's not always the case that someone will just come out with it and say, I'm thinking about taking my own life. Like, yeah, that's unlikely to be the case.
Oh, really? Is that the case?
Yeah. You know, so like, how, if as a lay person, you know, if I was desperately wanting to look out for my friends and family, like, what are those early signs that I could look out for? Or, you know, what are the indicators that might help me understand someone's fallen in the river?
Yeah. So we talk about these signs, as you call them, as invitations. So things that we may spot or notice and pick up on that we think, actually, that's an invitation for us to talk about suicide, for us to raise it with this person and engage in that topic. And they can fall into four categories. So they could be actions. They could be things that the person is doing, perhaps not looking after themselves very well at the moment, perhaps their physical appearance, they might have let that go a little bit, perhaps their risk-taking and just not considering their safety. Sometimes it'll be things that they may say, so talking a lot about perhaps being a burden, or, you know, that they'd rather not be here. Sometimes it will be feelings that we're noticing, so lots of sadness, lots of isolation, lots of anger. They can be quite common ones. And then also, you know, physical state. So if someone is quite withdrawn, or if they seem really apathetic and just not engaging with life really around them, then that's another kind of invitation that we can spot. But I think it's interesting to think about how we identify invitations between people around us. So like you were talking about friends, family, and people that we might be supporting in a professional capacity. So perhaps if we work for a housing association and we're supporting tenants, or if we're a support worker, that sort of thing. Because that relationship that we have with the person is obviously quite different. And what we would say is that it's generally a bit easier to spot these changes in people when it's people that you know. You know, so you can recognize and notice that change in their behavior or change in their demeanor. Sometimes it's harder when we're working on frontline services, because someone could be coming through the door and it might be the first time we've met them, and we're trying to decipher, you know, what's going on for them. But ultimately, I think if we start to recognize that there are invitations that are stacking up, then that's when we need to think about asking the question and just laying it on the line, finding out if suicide is something that person's thinking about. And I think, like you said at the top, like, fear gets in the way a heck of a lot. Fear of, am I going to offend this person? Fear of, what if they say yes, then what do I do? For a lot of people, you know, a fear of, am I going to plant the idea? You know, we try and dispel that as much as we can. And, you know, a lot of the evidence that underpins the training would say that just by asking the question, you're not going to plant that idea in someone's mind. But it is a really common fear that people have, you know. So there's all these things that get in the way sometimes that can lead us to kind of miss or dismiss or avoid asking the question. And it's often comes back to fear or our own discomfort, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, you're right. I mean, I remember being that person, you know, you kind of sit there and think, I don't want to ask because what if I make it worse? Or I don't, like you say, I don't want to ask because maybe they're not in a great place, but by asking, I put the idea in their head, and like, I would never live with myself if that was the case. And it's so good to know that actually that's a myth, I guess, in that actually that's not likely to be what happens. And I guess if you ignore it and do nothing, that's probably going to increase the chance of someone taking further action.
Yeah, I mean, if we think about the state that person that we're perhaps trying to support is in, they probably feel quite isolated, quite alone, quite disconnected. So anything that we do to ignore invitations or to handle that badly that serves to create distance, then that's not going to help the situation. What we need to be doing when we're trying to support someone is building rapport, building trust, and getting them in a space where they feel like they can have a really open and frank conversation with us. And stigma plays, you know, a big part in that. And it was only, I think, 1961 that suicide was decriminalised. You know, so there are people still alive today who, when they were younger, perhaps, you know, up until their 20s or so, suicide was a criminal offence. that you could get prosecuted for. And so that's got its own stigma that comes with it. Of course, you know, in many religions, it's deemed a sin as well. Hence, committing suicide as a phrase that was termed, it's got those negative connotations. So we try not to use that phrase. I mean, obviously, with NLP, language is very important and precise language is important. So we don't talk about committing suicide because it's got those connotations to committing a crime, committing a cardinal sin, that sort of thing. And of course, stigma goes two ways. So we, as the person trying to provide support, you know, we could have our own set of beliefs, our own set of stigmas that could be helpful or unhelpful in a conversation with someone that we're trying to support. But equally, that person that we're trying to support could have their own stigmas as well. I remember a colleague of mine, she was supporting a lady a few years ago who was a staunch Catholic, you know, and she was saying, you know, I've got all this judgment about suicide and I know that it's a sin and that I shouldn't do it, yet I feel it. And so that internal conflict was going on. So the reason I mention this is because I think a lot of the time when we're just starting to work with someone or trying to offer that support, they're likely going to be trying to get the measure of us, testing us a little bit to see, is this a safe person for me to talk to about suicide? Are they going to judge me? Are they going to, you know, phone work and tell them, or are they going to phone a local psychiatric unit? You know, there's all these fears that are going on for people. So I think we just need to take that all into account, really. There's a lot going on for the person before we actually start that conversation. We need to set it up to happen in a way which is conducive to that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I can totally see what you're saying. So let's say if we follow this kind of along its course, so let's say I've seen some of the invitations as they're called, and maybe someone isn't themselves. Maybe, you know, I've noticed them getting their affairs into order, talking about wills and things like that. And I've got the kind of signs, if you like. The next, I guess, question is, how do you start the conversation? I mean, how do you do it? I mean, do you do it gently? Do you call it out? Do you what would your tips be?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously this isn't going to come from nowhere. We've by this point probably been listening to the person for a little while, or we've been in conversation with them for us to start to pick up on these things that they might be saying, or, you know, the kind of gut feeling that we could get from the situation, I suppose. And at this point, it's very much about asking a really clear, direct question about suicide. We talk a lot in the training about guidance and how guidance will fluctuate when we're going through an intervention situation. And sometimes it'll be low guidance, other times it'll be quite high guidance. And for asking the question, it's definitely high guidance, because we want a really clear, precise answer to a clear, precise question. So we would always advocate asking the question, you know, as simply and straightforward as possible, really. And if you're comfortable to use the word suicide in that question, then do, you know, take some power back from it, use it and claim it. A lot of people do worry about how to lead into asking that question, I suppose. So one of the things that we talk about is a recipe for asking the question, really. So if you've noticed some of these invitations, there's a little formula, I guess, that you could drop that into, and you could say to that person, sometimes when a person is feeling X, Y, Z, they might be having thoughts of suicide. Are you having thoughts of suicide? So what you're doing for them is you're making that connection between the behaviours or the things that they're saying and how that links to suicide. You're alerting them to the fact that you've recognised that and you see that, and that you value the role that they have within that and the potential risk that could be there to them. But it's still a really clear way of asking. You know, there's no wriggle room with that. It's a yes or no response that we're going to get. So we're either going to know, yes, they're thinking about suicide and we need to do something about it, or no, suicide isn't what's going on for them at the moment, but perhaps we've learned something else about their story. We know that there's still something else that they might need some support with. If we've noticed these invitations, it's just not suicide. So a lot of people have a concern, I guess, about offending someone by asking the question. To me, that's just fear playing out again. That's just another reason not to ask. It's a bit of an excuse, perhaps. I've never really had a negative response from someone just by asking the question. Even when I've got it wrong, and I'll hold my hands up to that.
Really?
Yeah. You know, the worst I've had is maybe a bit of an odd look, and they've gone, oh, well, no, that's not what's going on for me. That's not what I meant. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that. What is it then? Because there's something else that's going on. I think ultimately it communicates a value and a respect, doesn't it? The fact that you care enough to put yourself in that scary place of asking the question.
Yeah, yeah, no, it does. It does. And you're right, you know, fear, you know, and I know we keep talking about it, but as a person wanting to help, you know, it's fear that stops me or could potentially stop me asking that question. And it could be fear that makes me maybe kind of allude to maybe what's going on, as opposed to, like you say, you need a direct question because you need to know. Like, you don't want them to dance around the handbag, do you? Like, in terms of when they answer the question and go, well, you know, I'm not been feeling too good. And it's like, is this the problem, isn't it? Essentially, that's what we're saying.
Yeah, and I always think using the words takes back some power from it. To me, to be scared of the word suicide, to be scared of having conversations around suicide only feeds that stigma.
Mm.
Yeah, so one of the things that I always ask people to do when they're going away from a training or a conversation with me around suicide is, you know, talk openly about it within your communities. Tell people that you've gone along to it, what you've learned about it. Because I think the more that we can start to identify ourselves around our people as someone who's comfortable and able to have those kind of conversations, the more chance that we've got of someone actually stepping forward and reaching out for support when they need it, as opposed to, you know, keeping it to themselves and potentially a bad outcome. I think another thing that sometimes happens as well is, you know, we're humans, sometimes we say the wrong thing as well. Sometimes that's because we're trying to play it down a little bit. Perhaps we don't want to create fear, or we're worried that we're going to create fear. So a really common one that I hear is people saying, you know, you're not going to go do something silly, are you? You know, and pretty much everyone that we get through the training room, they've heard some sort of version of that at some point. And I think, you know, phrases like that are problematic, really. They're problematic because, A, it's a bit of a leading question. We're kind of saying to them, we're really hoping that you're going to say no here. and so they might say no when actually they needed to say yes and get some support. But also to say you're not going to go do something silly, it's judgmental, isn't it? It's stigmatizing. Mm-hmm. It's implying that suicide would be a silly action, when actually, to that person, it is the most important thing that they're considering, the most important decision that they could ever make. It is literally life and death. So I think we need to respect the seriousness of the situation. And sometimes that is by just using the word and not trying to dress it up or dance around the handbag, as you say.
Yeah, no. And you're right. And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. It's, you know, it's being comfortable, as you say, isn't it? You know, the more we talk about suicide, the more likely we are to be able to help someone. You know, keeping it buried and not talking about it only drives the issue underground, doesn't it? And means that it's, you know, like you say, it's less likely that they're going to get the help that they need, you know. And I think, you know, I think one of the worries then, so once we've got over the word and we've got our heads in a place to say it's okay to ask outright, are you having thoughts of suicide? And when we're comfortable to do that, I guess the next worry as a lay person that you would have is, what if they say yes? You know, what do I do? Like, where does this go? You know, and what's my role? And am I the right person to ask this question? Like, all these things flood through your head, don't they? In terms of, you know, how you, I mean, this is not like a conversation you're going to have on the fly, is it? You know, walking down the corridor with someone at work going, oh, by the way, you know, that would be highly inappropriate.
Yeah, you definitely want to set those conversations up to happen in an appropriate way.
Exactly. So can you give everybody some tips around the appropriateness of when to ask, how to ask? We've just talked about, and so what? So if they say, actually, yeah, I am having thoughts of suicide, you know, what do I do next as the lay person trying to help?
Do you know, the next step really isn't all that complicated. It's listen, you know, once we've had a yes, if we get a yes, that's our time really to shut our mouths and just open our ears and listen to what's been going on for that person. You know, what is it that's brought them to this point where they're thinking about ending their life? You know, there's going to be a whole history there, and it's probably not going to be very nice hearing, is it? It's going to be probably quite negative, uncomfortable, difficult things that's been powerful enough to lead a person to that place. But that really is the most powerful thing that we can do at that point, is to listen. It's got tons of value, really, within an intervention. It offers that person a chance to offload and get everything that's been going on in their head just out aloud. We often refer to it as like a ball of wool in someone's mind. And going through the process of just letting them talk and us listening, it's an opportunity for them to unravel that ball of wool, really, and to set it out straight and get a bit of a clearer picture of what's gone on for them. So that kind of process of relieving pressure, I always think of it as like one of those old school kettles that you take off the hob. It just reduces that pressure to act in that moment if you can get that person talking. And also if they feel some temporary relief from talking and being heard, then that in itself might give them some hope that more talking in the future could lead to more relief, you know, and reducing those feelings altogether, perhaps. I think another thing that it does is us kind of creating the time and the space to really listen to them just helps them to feel validated and connected to someone else. And for a lot of people, you know, you could potentially be the first person that they've shared that with. They may have never told someone before that they've had those thoughts. So, you know, for them to kind of put that out there, put that on the line, with the backdrop of all those bits that we talked about earlier, of them being worried about, are they going to be judged? Is there going to be stigma coming their way? You know, it's a really big step for them to share that. So for us to say, okay, like I'm happy to just sit here and listen without any shocked expressions, without looking at my watch to see, you know, where I've got to go next, but just giving them that space that makes them feel valued. And I think, you know, the other thing, if we can incorporate some reflective listening within that as well, then that leads to reflective thinking on the part of the person that we're trying to support. So when it's all been internalized and they've not spoken it out aloud, they perhaps have a slightly different perception of what was and what could be versus when they've had an opportunity to lay that on the line with someone. So sometimes it can lead to new perspectives as well, is I guess what I'm saying. I think there's a risk, isn't there, that if we're in one of those roles where we're helping people, or if we're the person within our friendship group that often is prepared to have those conversations with our friends, we're probably a bit of a fixer kind of person. And I've got a lot of time for fixers, you know, great intentions and all. But actually, within a suicide intervention context, trying to rush ahead and fix the situation isn't what's required at that point. But it's required to kind of slow it down and just lay it all on the line and just listen to what's been going on for that person. The fixing, the steps forward, will come later, you know, and we'll think about who we get involved in that support plan or in that kind of care plan going forward to help the person. Because as you say, we might not be a professional in this role. A lot of the intervention skills stuff that we do is community-based, and intentionally so, because we've got that massive 155,000 people in Wales that might need a conversation. Clearly, not all those people are going to get to speak to a professional right there and then. So if we've got people in the community that know how to have these kind of early stage conversations, if they know how to make a situation safe, potentially disarm a suicide plan, but definitely some steps to help to make that person safe and to link them into further support, then that buys us enough time to link the person into professional services. So we, you know, we believe that suicide intervention is a skill for the community. Anyone 18 and up can come and train in programs like Assist, and there are other programs out there as well. But I think the crux of it is that we shouldn't consider it to be something that only the professionals have got a role to play in. You know, clearly they are a part of that ongoing support, but I think we've all got the ability and indeed a duty to step in when we spot those signs, when something doesn't feel right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's the big difference, isn't it? You know, and that was a big light bulb moment for me. Yeah. When you start to consider that, you know, the Assist training that you guys offer is community-based support for people. And I'm not being funny, but there's what, 3 million odd people that live in Wales, and the higher number of people that are willing and able to have those initial conversations, the safer we're going to make the community that we live in. I mean, you know, we have listeners on the podcast all the way around the world. And although we're talking about Wales, because that's where you and I live, Chris, you know, the same principle is everywhere. You know, Assist is an international program, isn't it? You know, so, you know, it's everywhere.
Yeah, we, you know, it's delivered in 26 countries around the world. We were asked a month ago if we would consider going out to Dubai, because it's just very recently been decriminalized in the UAE. Wow. So it's great to see that things are changing and that there's that appetite for people to learn these skills. And I think, as you say, the more people that we could have on that riverbank, taking it back to that analogy of the river of suicide, the more chances we've got of kind of fishing someone out or giving them a rope to hold on to when they're in that dark place.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I think you're right. I think that, you know, people like me and a number of our listeners to this podcast are people that are fixers. You know, we are very good at jumping in and wanting to find solutions and you know, and I can help you with that and things like that. But actually with suicide, that's not really the first step, is it? You know, like you say, the first step is just shut up and listen, you know. And like you say, you know, earlier, you know, it's a brave step on the person to actually have decided that you're a safe place. Yeah. And actually you may be the first person that anybody's ever told, you know, and just, you know, I mean, we all know, especially, you know, some of the NLP training we've got, you know, some people are external process, they need to think out loud, and mm-hmm. just being able to get all of this ball of wool out of their head and just say it out loud, all of a sudden they might start to find their own solutions to some of the challenges that have led them to this point. It's just our role, isn't it, to listen. Do you have any kind of, I mean, I don't want you to breach anybody's confidentiality, but to kind of any kind of case studies that you can share that might help people kind of get their heads around how this might play out in reality?
Yeah, so I guess there's a couple of, I suppose, lessons learned from when I was doing the one-to-one intervention work. I think, you know, the key overriding thing is that suicide is one of those topics that you can never be sworn to secrecy on. If you can imagine someone that's sharing that with you for the first time, there's a really good chance that they're going to, you know, put the pressure on, I suppose, not for you to share that any wider. I remember working with one person who, you know, we'd been working together for a little while, but on anxiety and depression, and things had come to a T, and suicide was something that we needed to talk about. And they told me what was going on. They shared that they had this potential plan of taking an overdose. But then they asked me not to tell anyone else. And I felt really uncomfortable about it, because I knew on the one hand, that's not how we're meant to do things. There's a policy and the policy says you don't do that. On the other hand, I've got this person that I've been working with for quite a while in floods of tears, you know, near on begging me not to tell someone back in the department what was going on for them. And of course, you have to do that. You have to share. Suicide is one of those things that you can't keep to yourself. I knew that I wasn't going to be on call 24/7 for that person. And so if something changed once I'd gone home, they were going to need to link into other support. So I did share, I did breach confidentiality, although it was within, you know, within our framework for how we would work. And, you know, process kicked in and that person was made safe, and we got hold of the medication and we disarmed it. Interestingly, in that situation though, the person spoke to me 2 weeks later and they said, I knew that you were going to have to tell someone, and I knew what was going to happen as a result of it, despite being there in floods of tears, begging me not to tell anyone. So I think it's interesting as well, isn't it, how when we're working in services where we've perhaps gone through, you know, data consent and confidentiality with clients that we're working with, sometimes that's their way of asking for support. Sometimes that's mm-hmm. their way of triggering a process that they know will keep them safe, despite what they may be saying in the moment about not wanting you to share that with other people. I think, you know, another aspect on it, we wear different hats, don't we? We're different things to different people. We perhaps have slightly different roles. And it can be really, really different supporting someone in our personal lives to supporting someone in a professional capacity. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we get people to think about on the training is, you know, there will be times when you're not going to be the right person to support a particular person, and that's okay. And, you know, there's all different things that legitimately can get in the way of us being a support. And that might be that the person is too close to us. You know, if you think of someone really, really close to you, like a partner or a family member, we might actually be part of the problem. We might not know it, but we can be part of the problem. So sometimes if we're too near to someone, then we might need to kind of look out to our wider network of caregivers and try and get support in from someone else. Other times, quite legitimately, there might be stuff that person's sharing which is really triggering for us if we've gone through similar circumstances. And so that needs to be a consideration sometime as well. But also, we're all only human. Even those of us that work in mental health, you know, we all have good and bad days. And for me personally, if I'm having a bad day, or if I'm feeling like I don't particularly have a lot of resource to give at a given moment, then there might be times when I decide to signpost to someone else and ask someone else that I know is ready, willing, and able to provide that support if I don't feel that I've got enough resource to give it my everything. And that's okay. You know, that is the right thing to do in those situations. So yeah, different scenarios where actually we might not be the right person to help. And I think we just need to give some weight to that, really.
Yeah, totally. Oh, that's so useful. Like, that totally makes sense listening to you. And I know I've done the course with you and I've heard that before, but it's so nice just to have it refreshed in your head and think, actually, it's okay if I'm not having a good day. You know, I shouldn't feel like it's my responsibility, but it is my responsibility to find them someone else to talk to. You know, even if I can't do it myself there and then.
We are all probably guilty of putting that pressure on ourselves, aren't we? To have to step up, to have to give everything, even when we don't have enough to give. And, you know, that's something that I'm getting better at myself. I hold my hands up to that. I overcommit sometimes. In fact, you know, I don't mind sharing. That's partly why we're doing this podcast now and not a couple of weeks ago, because initially, the week that you asked, I was like, actually, I'm just swamped. I really don't have the headspace for this. And I think, you know, it's a good thing for us to role model that, you know.
Totally. And that's why I was like, yeah, cool. You just let me know when you're available.
Yeah,
and
we'll do it.
At the end of the day, you're a mine of information on this subject. And to be able to share that with our podcast community, you know, around the world, you know, we're listened to, I think it's 65 different countries around the world now, you know, and to be able to get this message out, you know, is something that's worth waiting for. And I think people, when they're in your position in this example, shouldn't be afraid to turn around and say, yes, but not now. And, you know, and people that value you and respect you will be like, yeah, cool. Yeah. All right, no worries.
And, you know, there's always going to be other people that can support if you are in that situation where you can't be the, you know, the intervention support to that person at a given time. I think just across South Wales, I've personally trained a network of about 250 people from all different professions. We've had sort of community housing officers from social landlords on. We've had some members of the police. We've had paramedics. We even had a GP in our last one before lockdown. So I think it's really interesting, you know, when we talk about this being a skill that everyone can learn and practice, you know, to have a GP in the room, you know, who we put GPs on pedestals, don't we? And we think they are the answer to all of the problems, you know, but actually within their training, suicide intervention is probably a really, really small section of what they might cover. So that was really warming for me to see even those professional roles coming on the training thinking, actually, no, I want to do this better. I want to practice my skills more. And I think it's good for everyone else on the course as well to feel like actually this is something that we can all be on the same level and learn about.
No, definitely. Yeah, and there was a huge array of people on the course I was on. And it is. It's one of those things at the end of the day, we're talking about something that's really fundamental for all of us as human beings. Like you can leave your job title at the door because at the end of the day, you're just a person having a conversation with a person. And it doesn't matter who you are. And that's why I love this community-based approach to trying to help people. Because like you say, with the best will in the world, there are not enough psychiatrists and psychologists to go around.
No. You know, it's that listening is the crux, isn't it? I think ultimately, if you're a good listener, you would make a good support, a good caregiver for someone who's in crisis. Because the framework and the safety planning, that can all be taught. But actually, if you're not comfortable listening to someone else's pain, if you're not comfortable kind of shutting your lips and just being there and being present with someone, that's the stuff that counts really in this kind of work.
No, I remember when we were on the course and I can't remember the exact example that you gave, but once the conversation had started and the person was clearly looking at suicide, you know, it was the conversation that, you know, they just didn't feel like anybody had listened. And I remember that, like, you probably know the case study better than I do, but I just remember listening to you talk about that particular case study and sitting there thinking, wow, all they wanted was for someone to notice them. All they wanted was for someone to actually listen. All they wanted was for someone to say, are you okay? Mm. And nobody had. I think there was another one you shared on the course as well about the photographer. And there was, I'm going to get the case study wrong, but there was there was a man, I think, on a bridge, and there were a young couple, and they asked him to take a photograph. It was something like that. And that's just like ingrained in my head.
That was the example with the Golden Gate Bridge. So there, if you type in man on Golden Gate Bridge into YouTube, there's I think about an hour long documentary that you can watch with this chap, and he's one of maybe three people to ever sort of jump from the Golden Gate Bridge and survive, because apparently it's such a fall that it's like hitting concrete when you hit the water down below. And in this documentary, he talks about how he was stood on the bridge just on his own, looking down at the water below for years and ages and ages. And on a level, that was his invitation. And yeah, as you say, he was wanting someone to kind of notice him, validate him, break through that and offer some support. And he talks about how a couple approached him, tapped him on the shoulder, and he thought, oh, this is it. You know, someone's finally noticed. And then they just said, oh, can you take a picture of us while we're here? And he says in the documentary that in that moment, that's when he decided that, you know, that he held no worth, and he climbed over the bridge. And interestingly, though, what he does say is that the second that his foot left the railings of the bridge, he realized he did not want to do that. You know, so as soon as that control was out of his hands and he was about to be falling, he had that change of heart. He didn't want to die anymore. Unfortunately, he survived, and now he's a, you know, a great advocate for going around and talking about suicide prevention. But sadly, you know, not a lot of people get that second chance, do they, once they've committed to something like that?
No. I'm going to go and watch that YouTube video, because I never watched it, and you've just reminded me. So that's my activity for this evening. I'm going to go and watch that YouTube video. I'm conscious of time, and time, I just can't believe we've been here 50 minutes already. I'm conscious that we've talked a lot about suicide from the point of view of how to identify it. We've talked about having conversations. We've talked about listening, and all of those things. Mm-hmm. But can I take you right back to the very beginning, which is prevention at the very start is obviously a key part of preventing people from even sliding into this river in the first place. And the kinds of prevention tactics that any of us could use personally so that we don't ever end up slipping in that river in the first place ourselves. You know, what would you say are some really good mental health tactics that prevent things from escalating in this way?
So, I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to come back to self-care, isn't it? Those kind of activities that we can all be doing on a day-to-day basis that help to keep us well. And as you say, prevent us from hopefully ever falling into that river. It's also that old analogy, isn't it, of you can't pour from an empty cup. So particularly if you're in one of these helping roles where you're constantly giving and giving and giving energy, it's really important that we kind of focus inwardly now and then and just think about checking in with ourselves and looking after ourselves. And I think, you know, lockdown over the last few months has been a particularly challenging time for people. A lot of their usual self-care strategies or their things that they might have been doing, they don't have access to anymore. So I think we're all in a bit of a pressure pot just by virtue of the circumstance at the moment. But for me, some of the things that have been really helping, good sleep, because I know that if my sleep drops below 6 or so hours a night, I'm going to be a bit moody. I'm probably going to fall into low mood at some point, or I might get overly stressed or anxious. So as someone who does get anxiety and stress and low mood sometimes, I know that looking after my sleep is a really key thing. Exercise is really important for me as well. And so that's one of those things that since lockdown I've struggled with, because the gym was shut. It's taken ages to try and get any sort of exercise equipment delivered because everyone went out and ordered it straight away. But I think even if it's just, you know, going out walking, you know, that's a good start. And that's what I was doing for the first month, because that's all I had available to me at that point, that and a really half-assed jog because I'm rubbish at running. yeah, just physically moving, getting the blood pumping, moving around, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour, that's all you need to do. And chemically, it will lift you up. It will lift those hormones and chemicals in your brain. Another one for me is structure. I'm someone who needs a bit of structure in my day so that I feel like I'm making progress. I feel like I'm achieving things. And obviously, with lockdown, a lot of people lost that. Whether they were furloughed or whether they were working from home, and now all of a sudden they've got complete autonomy over how they run their day. I think I noticed within the first couple of days that there was a really good chance that I could have just slipped into staying in bed until about 5 to 9 and then hopping, you know, out of bed just before I needed to be online. But actually just planning my day a little bit so that so that I know that I'm making progress through the day early on was important for setting me up for a day. The news as well, limiting the news has been something that I've had to do recently. I think to start with, I was kind of all consumed with what was going on, had BBC News on in the background 24/7. And it's just all the same rubbish going round and round again, isn't it? And I think if you're just taking that in, even sort of subconsciously, it's not a good message to be giving yourself. So I cut that down quite quickly and just had like half an hour dose of the news, and that's enough now. Switch off and get back to my day. But I think, you know, the overriding one for people has to be talking, doesn't it? Using our networks, using our friendship groups, not pulling back, not isolating. And there's a real risk of that with lockdown because we're not able to get out and see people like usual. And I guess by this point, the kind of Zoom fatigue is set in, and the fatigue of another quiz on a Saturday night, you know. But I think if you can find those mechanisms to still keep in touch with friends, then that's a really key one. So hopefully with the changes that are happening now, we can have some social distance get-togethers in the park and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think we need that stuff to keep us all on the right path, I think.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and an array of brilliant tips and ideas there for people around prevention. And and it's one of the reasons, I guess, why they've always encouraged us to exercise. You know, I always think whenever I'm stressed or I'm anxious, I have to get outdoors. As soon as I go outdoors, whether it's down to the sea, whether it's in the woods, wherever, I just exercise and being outdoors. I love nature and I'm just such a fan of get outdoors and do something. And it's just brilliant.
And the outdoors is such an easy hack for mindfulness as well, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, sort of taking yourself away from all of the buzz of modern day life, I suppose. And I love just wandering like through the woods by us, just looking up at the trees. Yeah, perfect.
Funny enough, that's what I'm going to be doing very shortly. I'm going to take the dog out, which is my...
I like it.
I know. I love an evening walk. Chris, thank you so much for all of your experience and tips and techniques and sharing your experience. It's, you know, for a subject that I know a lot of people find difficult, I know, having listened to this podcast episode, there will be more people out there who will feel better equipped to ask the question and to listen. And that's such a great thing. Are there any final thoughts that you would like to share before we kind of wrap up?
I guess to give a plug really to one of the mental health services that we've got here in Wales, and I know this is Wales specific, but we've got a fantastic service here called Call, and it's, I think it's based up in North Wales, but all of the listeners on the phone line essentially are mental health trained professionals. So they've done mental health first aid, they've done programs like Assist, they know about suicide intervention. And I think if you're ever in a position where you're supporting someone and you're worrying sort of where to link them onto next, you know, perhaps if the GPs have shut for the day and you don't feel that it's urgent enough to call 999 or take that person to A&E, then Call are a really good resource to link that person into, because they can phone them day or night, they can text them as well, and they can get that conversation with an intervention trained specialist. So it just takes that pressure off our shoulder a little bit to feel like we don't need to be the person that's available 24/7. But they're also a great resource for us as well. So if we've been doing some particularly challenging interventions, and if we feel like we need to offload and debrief that, then, you know, we can phone up Call as well here in Wales, and we can just talk that through and debrief it with them and look after ourselves in the process.
Amazing, amazing. And of course, there are all sorts of other charities as well here in the UK, and I'm sure in other countries around the world. You know, just Google them. Google them in your local community and find those suicide support charities, because the more people that we can get involved trying to help, the better, as far as I'm concerned. So, Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So we talked a little bit as we've been going along about the two-day assist. I love my certificate, Chris. Thank you so much. But with the applied suicide intervention skills training, which obviously I did with you, according to this certificate, I did it February last year with you. So over 12 months now. Who'd have thought? February 2019, I did it with you. And obviously there's training material and certificates and things like that. And I, you know, I highly rate you as a trainer. You know, I think you're such, you're the right person in my eyes to go and learn this kind of stuff from. And I love your approach on it. And you've got so much experience. So if someone was interested in doing that 2-day assist course, do you want to just give everybody just a couple of minutes of what's covered in the course, and then we'll talk about how people can get in contact with you if they want to?
Yeah, sure. So the 2-day intervention training, we spend day one sort of looking inwardly, I guess, to start with, looking at our own experiences around suicide, our own belief systems around suicide, and getting to grips really with how that could play out in an interaction with someone. And we also introduce the pathway for assisting life, which is essentially our 6-step intervention model that we teach through Assist. Day two then is pretty much all about putting it into practice in tons of different ways. So we kind of build it up through challenge and safety throughout the day. But we do some big group simulations where me and the co-trainer will kind of run that through with you as a whole group. And then later on in the afternoon, you kind of split into pairs and practice it in different scenarios that you'll create yourself. I think the key thing for us is that everyone leaves the training room feeling confident that they could put it into practice as soon as they needed to, really. So, you know, I'm sure there are other trainings out there that run through the theory of everything within a day, but actually we really value the fact that we've got that second day to put it into practice, because similarly with your approach to the NLP training, Laura, I think if people are not practicing it and, you know, feeling confident in how they would do it in practice, then we've missed the trick there. So yeah, we don't have any open courses planned just yet because of COVID, but we're hoping to get some out before the end of the year. So people can just head over to thewellbeingguide.co.uk, and there's sections on there that tell you much more about the programs and also any sort of dates that we've got coming up for open courses soon.
Amazing. And again, just to make sure everybody understands, for all our listeners in America and Canada and all other countries around the world, Assist is an international program. So if you can't get here to train with Chris personally in Wales, which I totally understand, getting on a plane right now might not be what you want to do search your local communities for Assist registered trainers who will have done similar training to Chris, and go and get the education, go and learn those skills. And I'm with you, Chris, totally. I wouldn't have wanted to have done day one without day two. For me, day two is where my confidence started to grow. Yeah. Because I saw you run through the scenario, and then we ran through the scenario, and I was like, actually, do you know what? I think I could have this conversation. Yeah. And obviously, I've put your email address up here. If anybody wants to contact Chris, you can contact him at hello@thewellbeingguide.co.uk. So that's hello@thewellbeingguide.co.uk. So if you want to email Chris, that is the best way to get him. And of course, you can check out his website for all of the other things that he does. So awesome. Chris, thank you again so much. I really appreciate it. I hope everybody that's listened to the podcast today has enjoyed the podcast. I hope you've learned some stuff. If you want to check out the rest of the NLP Talks podcast, then please head over to nlptalks.com. And this is the third and final interview in our mini series for mental health. So stay tuned, because series 4 is already afoot. So watch out for details of series 4 coming out very, very soon. So brilliant. Take care, everybody. And we'll see you soon. Take care.
Take care. Bye.